I'm really honored to be here today and to say, really, I, like so many people here, do owe Ali my career. He employed me in 2002, just after I'd completed my master's degree here, to help him finish volume 5 of the collected papers, which was then only 30 years overdue. And I think the only reason he employed me is because when given a cup of tea, I asked for a coaster before putting it on his desk. And I always remember him looking at me and going, "You've had good training." So I have to thank my mother for a lot. And I suspect we've all got stories like that. I think he later gave me a legal job because I introduced him to scanning documents. And at the time, he was just becoming familiar with email, which he thought was a great invention. And I'd come into his office, in his garage, in his house every morning, and he'd look at me and he'd go, "Look," he would just marvel at the spam. "Why do they think that I would want all of these emails to enhance prowess?" Or, equally, requests for money from African dictators. So anyway, what I wanted to speak about today, and so many others have touched on it already, is Ali and the Art of Advocacy, or Sir Ali and the Art of Rhetoric. And I think this is because, like so many people who've had the privilege to see Ali on his feet, when someone asks you about his contribution to international law, that's automatically the first thing that comes to mind. And so with this in mind, I thought I would go back through his speeches as counsel and consider them against the teaching on rhetoric and advocacy. To set the scene, it may help first to consider briefly what that teaching is. For the teaching on advocacy, I turned to The Art of the Advocate by Richard Ducan, in large part because it was recommended to me by the bar school when I was training for the English bar, and therefore it was on my bookshelf. Mr. Ducan says that in speeches, unlike cross-examination, style matters a great deal. He further notes that, to a very large extent, the advocate cannot help carrying with him the stamp of his individual traits. Inevitably, they in part dictate the manner of his court behaviour. So what, pray, does Sir Ali's court behaviour tell us about his traits? Turning to the teaching on rhetoric, Aristotle tells us that rhetorical study, in its strict sense, is concerned with modes of persuasion, and that the use of persuasive speech is to lead to decision, whether political or legal. Persuasion, he tells us, must in every case be affected by first, working on the emotions of the judges themselves, or second, by giving them the right impression of the speaker's character, or third, by proving the truth of the statements made. And part of establishing the speaker's good character and friendly feeling of your tribunal, Aristotle tells us, is someone who has the tact to make and tell a joke. And along with metaphor, jokes are also important to the style of expression, conveying liveliness and helping arguments stick in the brain of the listeners by the element of surprise. As to jests, these are supposed to be of some service in controversy. You should kill your opponent's earnestness with jesting and their jesting with earnestness. So against this backdrop, I turn to Sir Ali's speeches. And with the help of my now assistant, we pass the tradition on, I have collected around 16 of them, where we identified where Ali appeared and we can find some record. There are no doubt more, but even just looking at that list, which unfortunately I can't show at the moment, but includes such great cases as Butte's Gas and the Tin Council case in the English courts, as well as Barcelona Traction and the nuclear testing case, and more recently, East Timor. It is not possible in the time available to undertake an analysis of Sir Ali's use of rhetoric in these cases in order to do it justice. So I'm just going to have to make do with a few examples. Really, reading his speeches is a masterclass, I have to say. Now, my favourite use of a joke I have found thus far in his speeches is in the merits phase in the El Salvador-Honduras case, where the issue was the closing line of the Gulf of Fonseca. And it goes something like this. "Professor Bauert has said he has never come across such an animal as the line that we now suggest exists, which is not the Legal Bay closing line. Well, I suppose that one should not allow Professor Bauert's knowledge of the world's fauna to set the limits to the range of legal possibilities." Now, this falls squarely into Aristotle's analysis of the deployment of jokes and rhetoric, being the repetition of a word used by your opponent metaphorically in its literal sense to literally kill his earnestness. And it is also instructive to see how Sir Ali uses humour to deal with some common problems faced by the advocate at an international court. To name but two, the unfortunate existence of an article one has published previously, which is contrary to your case, and boring the court. In Qatar and Bahrain, Sir Ali was arguing for Bahrain that there was no agreement to submit the dispute over territory and maritime boundaries to the court. As you no doubt recall, the submission to jurisdiction depended on the construction of a series of meetings. Qatar's counsel referred the court to an article by Sir Ali in support of their case. And his response to this was as follows. Sir Ian Brownlee was good enough to bring the attention of the court to the attention of the court an article that I had quite forgotten I had written some 18 years ago entitled Gentlemen's Agreements. How the follies of one's youth return to haunt me. Unfortunately, apart from reminding me of his existence, Sir Ian did not provide me with a text, and time has not permitted me to look it up again. But now that he has put the idea in my head, I can of course recall that there are many international texts of what might be called sub-binding quality, not intended to have legal force. So deftly deploying self-deprecation, Sir Ali turns a concession into a springboard for argument. And now to boring the court. What I like about this next example from his speech in the Ligatan-Sibitan case is how Sir Ali begins. Mr. President, members of the court, after hearing the comprehensive, encyclopedic, and extended presentation of my friend Professor Alan Palais, I'm not sure whether anything I could add would helpfully add to that. But of course he does so anyway. And after that very subtle suggestion about Professor Palais's speech, he goes on to draw the attention of the court to its response to his own speeches in the Tunisia-Libya case. He says, Malta set out in detail the nature of his claim he was acting for Malta. Perhaps it set it out in too much detail. Does one detect a note of weariness in the court's description of my humble efforts? I quote from the judgment. These specific elements, there were five of them, on which Malta bases its request, were further particularised at the hearing, when its counsel, Sir Ali, spelt them out for the court, point by point, coast by coast, bay by bay, island by island, sea area by sea area. So it seems the International Court of Justice is not beyond the employment of rhetoric either. It is only too easy for the audience to do, as Aristotle taught us to do, to invite the audience to fill in the gaps for themselves, in this case, mind-numbing. But after quoting from the judgment, Sir Ali says, and there was more after that. But what matters is not what the details were, only that they were detailed. Malta, in effect, spelt out its continental shelf claim. The court was fully informed. When its application was rejected, Malta was able to feel that its views on the substance of the matter were known to the court. Again, Ali moves from humorous self-deprecation to substantive submission, this time to remind the court of why sometimes it is our duty to our client to bore the court, and not really a reflection of our poor character, and perhaps delicately to remind them of their duty to listen. And this is not the only polite nudge we see in Sir Ali's speeches. A similar tactic is used again in the El Salvador-Honduras case, when on behalf of El Salvador, he sought to persuade the court not to assume jurisdiction over the delimitation claim. Mr. President, in international courts, one I think naturally tends to be on the side of the angels in seeking to expand the jurisdiction of a tribunal, particularly if it is coupled with the plea that the extension of the jurisdiction will somehow, it is believed, end the dispute. But that is not the correct way to approach this case. this chamber or this court knows how to say no to attempts to expand its jurisdiction beyond the proper limits of the compromis. And it was his earnest hope that it would do so. And there are many other such examples that I can take you to where allies' employment of very elegant language and humour are deployed to devastating effect. Which brings me to my last point. So how persuasive in the result was Sir Ali? What was his strike rate? Counting the two instances of Bute's gas as a single instance, we collected around 16 disputes that Sir Ali participated in. Unfortunately, despite his obvious evident talents in rhetoric, 13 of these were at least partial losses. How can this be explained? I venture to suggest by reference to the facts. Even Aristotle concedes that nevertheless, the underlying facts do not lend themselves equally well to contrary views. No, things that are true and things that are better are, by their nature, practically always easier to prove and easier to believe in. For his part, Richard Ducan notes, the advocate does not live by style alone. Facts are the bricks with which he builds, and style, at best, the mortar to bind them together. Even Sir Ali could not make purses out of sow's ears. But what he does do for all of us who followed in his footsteps is set the standard and tone for the art of the set piece, which is the skill of an advocate in an international court, and the skill of international advocacy. And for that, we owe him a great deal.